Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate that I'm a poor apology for Michael Ancrew, but I'm standing in his absence, and it's a great honour to do so. And thank you very much for all coming today. I've been asked to mention that Ambassador Winkler, representing the Czech Republic, died recently. He's been a regular attender of these meetings, and I'm sure the meeting would want to send a message of condolence to the Czech representation and to his family in the United Kingdom. Without further ado, the title of our discussion today is Georgia, Better In or Out of NATO. We have two very distinguished guests. First, we have Oksana Antonenko, who is a senior fellow at IISS, in charge of the program director for Russia and Eurasia. She wrote a book in 2004-05, Russia and the European Union, Prospects for a New Relationship. And she will now be able to tell us how that relationship is developing. Oksana, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much. I will stand up. I hope you will be better to hear me. I think, first of all, I would like to thank very much for this opportunity to be able to speak today on this subject, which undoubtedly now represents, in my view, one of the most challenging, not only politically, but I would also say intellectually, issues for the European security agenda. I think it is also useful, either by design or by default, so to speak, that we actually are having this meeting later, that it's has not happened too close to the events of August, when, of course, the emotions were very high among all of us, particularly those who have been involved, as I was for many, many years in Georgia. But I think this 6 months that passed since the war was an appropriate time for reflection and perhaps for introspective sort of reconsidering of what this war really was about, and what it means and will mean in the future for the European security agenda, including for the most, as I said, challenging issue of Georgia's future membership or relationship with NATO. I will start my talk with sort of confession, which I think these days, if we talk about any issues on the Caucasus, this is very appropriate to do, just to say a few words of how I see the August events. And I think it is very important that until today we have not yet arrived to a consensus of what actually happened in August. Of course, we know that the EU Commission is currently working hard to ascertain facts and draw conclusions. So from my perspective, I will just say a few words of where I stand on this issue, which I think is, of course, very important for the future of my talk on the conclusions I draw from that on the Georgia-NATO relationship. First of all, ladies and gentlemen, I do know believe personally that this war was about Russia setting a trap for punishing Georgia and preventing it from joining NATO. Although I do believe, of course, that Russia's actions in Georgia has been totally unjustifiable and disproportionate and damaging to Russia's own interests, be it globally or within the region. Secondly, I believe that this conflict was essentially, in my view, a failure of the conflict resolution policies on the part of the Georgian government. I spent 2.5 years of my life as one of the mediators in the TRAC-2 process in the Georgian South Ossetian peace process, and I've seen it very much from the inside of how many opportunities were missed and wasted by the Georgian government, who, of course, was the main demander in this process, seeking to bring South Ossetia back under Georgia's control. And the third issue, of course, for me, which is very important about this war, that I think it represents a profound fundamental failure of the international community and all the European institutions, not only the OSCE, which has been primarily responsible, of course, for Georgian South Ossetian conflict, but also NATO and the EU and other actors. Because in many ways, the conflict of August, in my view, again, was completely predictable and preventable. But we have not done enough by being too complacent about the so-called frozen conflicts, which, of course, never been frozen, and by encouraging very unhelpful and reckless behavior on the part of the Georgian government. which of course led us to where we have been in August. So with that summary, I hope it will then be a bit more logical of what I'm going to say now in answering the very question which was posed to us by the organizers. And the question, of course, is it better for Georgia in or out of NATO? I think I will try to rephrase this question a little bit to kind of disaggregate it by saying better for whom? And I think this is very important. Is it better for NATO? Is it better for Georgia? Is it better for the European security? And I will try to answer all these three questions in order. First of all, is the Georgia's membership in NATO better or worse for NATO? And I think this should be our fundamental concern, of course, given that we are in Europe now and we are concerned about NATO surviving and developing, you know, through in the future very much as a very important transatlantic security institution. I think in principle my answer would be yes, Georgia's membership in NATO could be good for NATO. It would be good for NATO, of course, because it is because of Georgia's location in the Caucasus, which is, of course, increasingly becoming a very pivotal region, important for NATO's current engagement in Afghanistan, possibly future engagements further afield. Because Georgia has an experience, a very important experience of contributing its own troops and resources to the multilateral efforts, be it in Iraq or in the Balkans or indeed now in Afghanistan. And thirdly, because of course we also know that Georgia is one of the few countries in the post-Soviet space that has embarked once upon a time on the very important democratic reforms, and that should be encouraged, including through NATO. So from that point of view, in principle, my answer is yes. But in practice, however, my answer is no. And why is that the case? I think, first of all, it is important that today, it is important to acknowledge that today, Georgia does not meet the criteria which NATO has set up for its membership. And I think any attempt to circumvent this criteria for political expediency, and we have seen that very much, of course, being performed in Bucharest, where the statement said that Ukraine and Georgia will be members of NATO without any qualification to them being able to meet all the criteria that NATO has. And that, I think, in many ways damaged NATO's credibility. The second issue, I think it is also important that Georgia has not yet accepted the core principles which underline the NATO's very essence or very philosophy on which it is built. That is no use of force to address the conflicts, be them internal or interstate. And of course, we have seen, and I think it is now, of course, we are waiting for the reports from the Commission, but a number of very, very reputable, of course, international organizations like Human Rights Watch and others have already reported that Georgia has violated in many ways the principle of proportionality and in many ways human rights by using force in South Ossetia. The third issue is that Georgia's democracy now, although several years ago it was, of course, very vibrant and promising, is today in trouble. It is in trouble from last year when we have seen, of course, use of force against the opposition on the 7th of November in the elections, a number of elections in which major violations have been reported by the international observers. And, of course, it is now also in trouble because there is no sense that the opposition are now incorporated or participating in a meaningful way in the power sharing in the institutions within the government. I think the fourth reason why I think Georgia is not ready from the point of view of NATO is because it has not normalized its relations with Russia. And of course, one of the core requirements for NATO for accepting a member is to have settled relationship with NATO. Of course, I'm very aware, more than probably anybody else, about how much it is not just Georgia's fault, or probably much less of a Georgia's fault than it is of Russia's fault. It always takes to tango and two countries to normalize their relations. But at the same time, I think the actions of the Georgian government has not been helpful, in my view, both in terms of use of rhetoric which was used and certain other steps which were taken of moving or transforming these relations towards improvement in the last several years, not to speak about the August events. And finally, of course, which is also important, is Georgia still has unresolved conflicts on its territory, which after the August war have very little prospect, in my view, in the foreseeable future, of resolution along the lines that Georgia aspires to, and that is the restoration of Georgia's territorial integrity and Georgia's full control over Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And as long as this issue remains on the agenda, by accepting Georgia in NATO, of course, NATO will accept the legacy of those conflicts, which could one day, of course, put NATO and Russia on the path of direct confrontation, which is something we have managed to avoid, ladies and gentlemen, throughout very difficult years of the Cold War. So the second question, in my view, is NATO membership better for Georgia or not? And again, my answer in principle is absolutely yes. I mean, Georgia is a very unique country in the post-Soviet space. That is, its population overwhelmingly supports NATO membership. And all the opinion polls and the results of the vote and the referendum indicate that, which, of course, you know, gives Georgia, Georgian government an absolutely important legitimacy behind its aspirations to join the alliance. Secondly, of course, it is also important because a number of very influential Georgians believe that by joining NATO or by embarking on the path towards integration with NATO, it will help to, again, create a momentum behind democratic reforms and to improve institutions and to entrench the European values in the Georgian society. And I think this is, of course, very, very important. And I think, of course, also for Georgia, it is NATO membership, as it has been, of course, in other countries of Central and Eastern Europe, is also linked to broader aspirations of joining the European and transatlantic community, including coming closer to the European Union and European Union membership. Now, today, however, I think it is not good for Georgia to think about it moving closer to NATO or pursuing very actively NATO membership. Why it is not? I think because the society, if we look closely at what is happening in Georgia, is not, in fact, ready for embracing NATO for what it is, but not what they think it is. And I think if we look again at the same opinion polls, which show very, very strong support for NATO membership, the majority, more than 50% of the population, see it not as the end in itself, but as the means to the end. And that is essentially for restoration of Georgia's territorial integrity. And I think as long as this approach remains to be very much part of the Georgian political mentality and the political discourse, that is not going to be helpful, because it is going to bring us more over and over and over again to the issue of the conflicts which Georgia so far has failed to resolve on its own territory. I think it is also, in many ways, a substitute. The discourse about joining NATO is a substitute in Georgia for the serious discussion among its political elite on what to do about relationship with Russia. The assumption is that, well, you know, how about if we come closer to NATO, the EU, they are going to be dealing with the issue of Russia. You know, we are going to export this problem to the wider international community who will speak to Russia on our behalf. But I think Georgia has to do a lot more homework, because any serious consideration should be given. It has to, and its government has to lead and shape a consensus within its own society on the viable strategy of how to transform relationship with Russia without, and I very much, of course, insist on that, without undermining Georgia's sovereignty and its aspirations for democratic and Western-orientated society. And finally, I think it is also important to emphasize that Georgia's government's kind of over-optimistic promises about the Bucharest summit and the fact that the Bush administration fully supports Georgia's NATO membership has made a very bad service, I think, to the Georgian society, because when that has not been realized in Bucharest, I think the backlash and the kind of the mood we have seen in the country, you know, really contributed, to my view, to a large extent, to what has happened in August. Because there has been, I think, the kind of loss of faith in the international institutions. And I think we need to be realistic, for the sake of the Georgian society, of how far, so in reality, Georgia remains from obtaining this important goal, but keeping very much the door open and giving opportunities for Georgia to change and to move closer to their lines. Finally, is Georgia's membership in NATO better for the European security or not? And I will be very brief on that, because I think after August the answer is quite obvious. But at the same time, I would say that in principle, again, it could be very good for European security. It could be good for European security because it will represent it will send a very clear signal to Russia that the international community and the transatlantic community in particular does not accept any of the spheres of influence, the geopolitical approach on which Russia insists, that it assesses countries on the merit, and it supports the sovereign right of every nation to decide to join the alliance or not, whenever it is ready. And I think that is, of course, very important. And it is also, I think, good, because Georgia's membership in NATO would be able to broaden NATO's role in the Caucasus, in the energy security arena, and other important new objectives, which we are likely to see reflected in the new NATO strategy concept, which will be elaborated and hopefully adopted soon. However, today, pushing Georgia closer to NATO will be very damaging, in my view, to European security. It will ruin relationship with Russia exactly at the moment when, following the August conflict, we now have a window opportunity to start strategically rethinking this relationship, which, will, to be, let's be honest, have failed in the last two decades. It, of course, will put our other important interests at risk, including NATO's mission in Afghanistan and the issue of non-proliferation in Iran, in which we do need Russia's cooperation. It could drag NATO into being more involved in the regional conflicts in the South Caucasus, in which NATO at the moment has no constructive role to play, I would argue, because it is not the military and security, but the political and economic process which are going to be able to produce the conflict transformation we need for making a progress. And finally, it will also complicate the relationship between NATO and some of its other neighbors. Because clearly, in a situation when Georgia's membership will be so divisive, it will be much harder for some of the countries who also seek to pursue closer ties with Russia to continue to develop relationship with the alliance on the same footing that they have done before. So let me summarize. I think my argument is that in principle, Georgia's membership in NATO is a good idea. It will be good for NATO, it will be good for Georgia, it will be good for European security. However, we have to be prudent and realistic of when this option should be really put on the table. And the cost of putting this option on the table before the conditions are right will be bad for NATO, bad for Georgia, and bad for European security. Thank you very much.
Well, a very concentrated case you've put in exquisite English, if I may say so. Thank you very much for that. I would summarise your answer to the question as yes but no. And now we move to General Sir Gary Johnson, former Assistant Chief of the Defence Staff, served all over the world, in the Far East and Northern Europe, but has had extensive experience in Russia-West relations in the Baltic and also in the Caucasus. Sir Gary.
Thank you.
Do stand up if you wish.
Yeah. I can see the rabbits on the back of the dogs and keep me stand up. I go quite frequently to the Caucasus and came back the last time a couple of weeks ago. So I got a bit of the mood down there as well as the arguments. I know Oksana goes down almost more often than I do. So we are fairly close to what goes on down there. I speak more of, as a practitioner than as an academic or somebody who approaches it from that perspective, and therefore I might be a little blunter than Oksana felt she was able to be, and if I am, then I hope you will forgive me in this audience and perhaps take it under Chatham rules if I step on anybody's toes. I approach the issue rather like Oksana, on taking the lawyer's principle of cui bono, to whose benefit, and then split it down and looked at a number of the players in this game and asked what they would be making out of that question. And if you start with Georgia, then it is clearly, in the view of Georgia, to their benefit to be in NATO. They do see it, I'm quite sure, as Oksana said, as part of the means to the end of ensuring not just their territorial integrity, but to their independence as a nation. It is as serious as that in the eyes of a Georgian. 3 days, 2 days after I left Georgia last time, Russian soaps were banned on the television, on the radio. the school children stood outside their schools with flags. The cars drove slowly through the centre of Tbilisi with the Georgian national flag honking their horns. It was the anniversary of the occupation of Georgia by the Russians in 1921, which then lasted for 70 years. If you live with this thought, you see it differently than if you live in comfortable Western Europe or this country, where, thank God, we have been at peace for my adult life. So there is a perspective which we have to factor into our rational discussions. They do believe it would be better. They do believe it would guarantee their freedom. They do believe they need it because they live in fear of reincorporation into the Russian Federation, or at least of such dominance by the Russian Federation that they become a vassal state. And they would point to the events of August as being a demonstration of intent in that area. And I do take a different point of view from Oksana on the events leading up to that, which I will return to later if you'd like me to. So from the point of view of a Georgian, I think almost all Georgians, yes, of course, it would be better to be in NATO. There is no alternative other than subservience. And as one minister put it to me a couple of weeks ago, we have to stay the course. There is no other alternative for us. And that was in response to my probing a little and saying, now that you've been rebuffed by NATO, what are you going to do? Are you going to go for armed neutrality? Are you going to take a Finnish, a Swiss view of life? And I have no doubt that that option has been discussed and talked out, because it isn't quite good enough. And so they will continue to desire to be in NATO. Tactically, they understand the difficulties at present, and therefore, in playing the game, the EU will be given greater prominence, but the two are inextricably linked in their minds, and they will continue to desire membership. What about the other player in that region? Is it to the benefit of Russia that Georgia enters NATO? It's an equally opposite no, and a pretty easy one to draw. Why should that worry Russia? And I think you have to take, and I speak as a former general, and therefore shall be accused of being a Cold War warrior, which I assure you I'm not, but I do speak with some experience of the background. I do think that we have to not look at developments in Russia through rose-tinted spectacles. We do not have to think that by being nice to them, they will be necessarily nice to us. They do have a different approach, and so they should do. They are an independent nation. They take their own view. Their foreign policy is for their own ends and not for ours. I think the problem in Russia, never mind the build-up of nationalism and reassertion of power in crude terms under Putin, I think there's a greater problem there, and it stems from their history and their geographical position. I think I would characterise it as a sort of strategic paranoia. Somehow or other, they think we're all out to get them, as if anybody would want them. But that's the way they think. But then again, if you try to understand why, if you've been invaded by the French under Napoleon, by the Germans under the Kaiser, by the Western powers in the Bolshevik era in 1920-21, including the Brits, by the Germans again in the Second World War, if you live in a nation like that, which has seen aggression coming from the West, then you are going to be touchy about it. And if somehow or other you feel that that aggression is bent on demolishing your system and your way of life, you're going to be double touchy about it. Now, we could quite reasonably say, but this is lunatic. We mean no offence to anyone, nor do we, nor should we. But I guess it doesn't look like that from Russia. Now, if I was a Russian strategic planner sitting in the MOD in Moscow, I would be saying something like this to them. And I would be harking back to strategic planners under Stalin and under the Tsars. And I'd be saying, we are a great nation. We should stand equal with the other great nations and organizations. To do this, we have to do a certain number of things, mainly to secure our position and secure our borders. We need a firm hand on the high north. And we've already seen indications of turbulence building in the high north. The Norwegians, the Danes, the Canadians have been nervous about this problem for a decade or more. and we are now beginning to see more Russian flights, more propaganda things like putting the flag on the bottom. We're warming up for a tussle over dominance, over the resources, over the territory, in a very old-fashioned way up there. I would then say to my bosses, you want to make damn sure that we don't get invaded again from the West. Therefore, we want strategic depth. We want a glacier of states. Remember, we used to have them in the Warsaw Pact. That either do what we tell them or don't do what we don't want them to do. Therefore, the advance of NATO in Europe, which has gone too far, must now be stopped. There must be no more NATO expansion. And I would work that argument round to the South and say from that you must not allow the West, NATO, single nations to gain a toehold south of the Caucasus Mountains. Because I would drag out my old Tsarist text, which says that Mother Russia is defended in the south, south of the Caucasus, not north of it. I would then go on to talk about the problems of the East and the necessity of securing our north, west and southern borders, because the trouble is going to be in the East in 20 years' time, with all these great empty regions in Siberia and those sprawling masses of Chinese trying to expand. And I would go back and look up the old things on the confrontations on the Amur River and point to that as some form of justification for my text. I would then finish off by saying, and my masters, just think what fuels our economy, its natural resources. It is oil and gas, and where are the greatest of those resources, if not in Russia, that we can get our hands on in Central Asia? Therefore, we must have a stranglehold over the passage of natural resources, gas and oil, coming out of Central Asia to the West. We've achieved it pretty well with Europe, some of the nations of Europe, and we've got them by the proverbials, and it is political muscle to us. And we should therefore look to be doing the same in the South. Now, you will say to me that that's old speak, and it is. But I do think that this is the way it is viewed in Russian thought. It's classical, old geopolitics, realpolitik, which would have been very familiar to all of us if we'd been speaking here in the second half of the 19th century. So, no, it's not in Russia's interest that Georgia is in NATO. What about NATO's interest? Officially, yes, the door's open, my friends. The door is always open to hospitality to our friends who wish to join. Well, you have to say that, don't you? Especially if you're a diplomat, painting the best face on it. You have to say that if you're a politician, because you're covering what little ground you have left and dressing yourselves with a few clothes which are respectable. But is it? What is going on in NATO? We know, the Georgians know, the Russians know, that NATO is split apart on this issue. There are those nations who do not wish, and did not wish in the past, to have NATO expansion, who will resist it in the future. And let us name them. Germany was not at all happy about the first expansion. It wasn't happy about the second expansion. It's not happy about the predicted third. It went along with the first expansion, because in those days, Russia was too weak to oppose it, and the Americans were strong enough to push it through. The second expansion was more nuanced in the way it happened. In this third expansion, those who oppose it know that Russia is strong and the West is divided and the United States has lost its power through the lack and loss of its moral authority resulting from the adventures in Iraq and to a lesser extent Afghanistan. So the naysayers will be strengthened. The French will be fast up behind, but they'll always play slightly differently. And there are others on the southern tier who are not so welcome. The military, interestingly enough, have never been particularly pro-expansion, because it spoils their nice, cosy little club and their nice, well-oiled machines. So there's always been a bit of undercover resistance from most militaries to expansion on the grounds that it will lower the efficiency of the organisation and make it less fit for purpose. And that is why you get in the military support of the technical requirements which Georgia must pass and other nations before they're considered fit, which plays back into the hands of those who wish to manipulate it, because those cursors can be put high or low according to what result you wish to come out of it. Now, there are those nations, of course, within NATO who desperately wish Georgia to be in. I heard the president of Estonia say, I think about 12 years ago, that the security of Estonia is the security of Georgia, and vice versa. The Baltic states in particular have always feared that if Russia can get away with it in Georgia and the other South Caucasus nations, they are in peril. They now feel that the inability of the West to support in hard terms a Georgia under aggression calls into question the depth of the guarantee given under Article 5 in NATO. This is not said openly, but it is thought about on bad days. What about the United States? And I said, it doesn't have the power to do it at present. Will it have that power? Will it want to do so? The messages have been sent out from Clinton and Biden to NATO. Yes, we support Georgia. We strongly disapprove and condemn Russian acquisition of territory in Georgia. At the same time, we press the reset button, so we're told, and America wants a new relationship with Russia. If you press that reset button and talk about it in Tbilisi, they ask, at what cost? At what cost to us and our independence and our freedom? What about the UK? When I'm asked about UK policy towards the expansion of NATO and to Georgia, I remind people of Lord Palmerston, maybe his well-known thing about British foreign policy as the man in the punt drifting down a stream, and when the bank gets too near, you leisurely push out a pole and get yourself back somewhere in the midstream. So I'm kind to my friends in the FCO. There's a certain element in it, but I think it's more that we, if you like, the Brits, tend to keep our options open, tend to keep our powder dry, and tend to make our decisions later. We're not particularly good on policy formulation at an early stage. We feel we're better at pragmatic adaptation at a later stage. And to my friends in Georgia and elsewhere, I've always said, trust us, we normally get it right in the end. I have on occasions had my fingers crossed behind my back when I said it. So I think that UK has come out in support of Georgia, politically, very strongly. The visit first by David Cameron and later by the Foreign Secretary were well received in Georgia as being indications of firm support politically when it was required. But, as they say in the United States, where's the beef? What's behind the words? Not much. And the Georgians are beginning to say just that. How do we work it? What do we do next? So, to try and sum up the NATO pros and cons, it's a mixed bag, really. Do I think it would be better for NATO? Yes, I do. Because I believe that the NATO expansion has brought stability to Europe. It has contributed to that peace in Europe, which I talked about. I mean, if you go back to that old Edwin Jebb saying about NATO's there to keep the Americans in, the Germans down and the Russians out, it is true today, in different words, NATO is there to keep the Western alliance afloat. The bonding between the political, economic, military power of the New World and the Old World is going to be seriously important to us all in my children and my grandchildren's generation. It is there not to keep the Germans down. It is there to keep the peace in Europe. We cannot fight ourselves amongst ourselves because of NATO. We must not renationalise defence. We are interwoven. Therefore, it has a preventive purpose, which Russia should be quite glad of. Is it there to keep the Russians out? No, I don't think the Russians want to come storming in. But it is there to keep out the sort of threats that we see developing now and will develop in the future, which you cannot quantify by reference to the past. So for those reasons, we need NATO. I think we need to complete the expansion of NATO and persuade Russia that this is in no way aggressive. We won't succeed, but we must try, because it ensures that stability. And as a final point for the United Kingdom, we are as dependent on oil and gas as any other developed nation. A fair percentage of it is now coming out through Central Asia and the Caspian. It's coming out south of the Caucasus, some of it. If that route is not open to us, we will regret it in our national strategy. Therefore, we have a national interest in supporting Georgian membership of NATO. So, in pragmatic terms, I think I come down as yes. In principle, I agree entirely with Oksana. I do actually agree with her over timing. It is extremely difficult at present. I don't see NATO pushing forward beyond what it's doing. For all the verbiage, and the Georgians have had 10 years of verbiage, during which they've done everything that was asked of them. They didn't pay off when the chips were down, and they really needed their friends. So unless we can do something more practical to show our support, I think that the NATO dream will remain a dream for quite some time. What do I mean by practical? I don't know. But I look at the US-Georgia Commission and think that they're probably the one nation that might do something practical. I'm not sure what NATO will do. Probably not a great deal more than it's done in the past, which is helpful, but will individual nations do more? Probably not. But we have to look at those alternatives in such a way that we do not tar ourselves as reviving the Cold War, but that we do ensure that peace and stability extend further out of Europe and into the South Caucasus. It's in our interest to do so. Thank you.
Well, that was another fascinating account. Thank you very much indeed. I would characterise it as yes, but it's complicated.
Just do it, sir.
Just do it. Okay. Just do it.
No, probably not.
Yes, but it's complicated. I should make a confession myself. I've just been in Moscow and Georgia with the Defence Select Committee and met President Saakashvili last week, and he is absolutely convinced, in answer to your question, what should we do, that the arrival of the American 7th Fleet in the Black Sea stopped the Russians in their tracks, and that the earlier admonitions about disproportionate use of force were taken as by the Russians as permission to carry on with the invasion. He doesn't seem to think that we would need to do very much of that nature to demonstrate to Russia that it would be too high a cost for them to attempt to annex the whole of Georgia. But you may disagree. Let's have some questions. Well, yes, sir?
Nicholas Batbank. Gerald, you said you'd share with us your views about the events of last August.
Oh, yes, please.
Well, I will, certainly. I do digress. I do take issue with Oksana. And I do so on the basis of no briefing, which, other than my knowledge and reading the newspapers, I know nothing about the actual facts that were gathered. It seems to me very clear that my diplomatic friends tell me Russians are good at tactics and not so good at strategy. I actually disagree with that. I think they're quite good at both, and I've tried to outline a strategy into which I believe the August events fit. And they were tactically, I think, extremely well handled. At Bucharest summit, which I believe was a disaster for NATO, because for the first time, Russia split NATO down the middle in public, something that Stalin had failed to do for 50 years. It was taken, I am reliably assured, at certain levels in Moscow, as a sort of signal that we wouldn't mind too much if they got on with some business down there. If they'd got map, was the word, the Russians would have taken that as a signal the other way. What happened after the Bucharest summit was a fairly wholesale issuing of passports to people in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, Russian passports, so that they became Russian citizens, which is, of course, a prelude to our citizens are in trouble. We have been invited in to restore the peace in Hungary, Czechoslovakia. There are many examples of that sort of rationale going on. You look at the increase of so-called peacekeeping troops in Abkhazia, not just paratroopers, and I was there in Georgia when this was going on, but engineers to rebuild roads and bridges and strengthen bridges so that they can take armoured vehicles. You look at the exercise which was carried out just north of the mountains, just north of, in North Ossetia, for 2 weeks leading up to August, which did not disperse to barracks when it was when the exercise finished, which was held there. And I believe you can see a deliberate pattern of events. Now, what happened in August, I don't know who said what to who and when. I believe that that the Russians were well prepared to take advantage of an irrational, illogical reaction, emotional reaction, in Tbilisi to the shelling of their people with caliber weapons which would not have been held in South Ossetia, coming out of South Ossetia. Now, what does Saakashvili do then? Does he sit and take it? Political death. Does he do something about it? If you're going to do it, you've got to do it properly, and it wasn't done properly, and they got a bloody nose. Having said that, I believe that Russia failed to achieve two of its obvious war aims. One was regime change, and one was the exclusion of the West from NATO, because we're still in there by our fingernails.
Very interesting. Next question. Bruce.
Isn't the danger that any overextended organisation, you mentioned Gary's book as a disaster, yeah, certainly, but any organisation that's overextended is automatically weakened?
Yes, that is a very strong military argument, which I have made myself in the past, sir. But how many nations are there in NATO now? They grow like topsies, so I've won 26, something like that.
Shouldn't the priority be a new form of collective security, which doesn't abolish NATO, but it's actually something that involves the Russians as well? We try to lock the Russians into it. We keep our... It's time almost to scrap our concept to keep our weapon systems with the old NATO, to find a new concept of European collective security which includes Russia, and which could expand not only into the Caucasus and the Balts, but further east into the Stans and Gitters.
Yeah, I think it'd be lovely. I believe in Christmas as well. I think we have changed in NATO enormously. It's not the machine that I knew when I was in it. It has changed. It has become more flexible. It is not there for the same purposes as before. It works differently. It is collective. If Russia were willing to cooperate with it, then I'd be absolutely delighted. They have been asked so often. But I think the problem is that they do not see themselves as a nation. They see themselves as an equal with NATO. So it's a problem for them.
You want to add something?
Yeah, it was fascinating to listen to Sir Gary giving him Russia's perspective on the world. You know, you probably should go and try to give a lecture in the Russian General Staff Academy. This is like an intelligent version of the Russian, you know, military brief. But I think actually I disagree. I certainly disagree on that. I think that this is our only option going forward, is creating a new, not even European, but Eurasian security system in which Russia and the NATO members and NATO and other institutions are all together, you know, to deal with issues which will face us. I mean, I certainly very firmly believe that NATO is fighting an existential mission in Afghanistan. I can hardly imagine that if NATO fails in Afghanistan, which seems to be, you know, by the situation on the ground, is a very likely possibility that we will be able to see NATO as we knew it. And I think the whole questions about whether Georgia, Ukraine, or any other countries will or will not be members of NATO after that would be irrelevant, in my view. What I think we need now is to develop a system in which Russia could be made a stakeholder in Eurasian security in a way which does not involve the kind of the extension of the Cold War paradigm, but a completely new approach in which we really all pitch in to deal with the problems like Afghanistan, which is very, very serious, will get worse, like Pakistan, like Iran, like, you know, possible instability in Central Asia, like, you know, transforming the international system. And I think it is not only Russia, but I also believe China needs to be involved. We need to find a completely new formula in which, you know, we not think about, you know, who is, you know, did what during Napoleonic times and what perceptions they have based on that, but how we go forward. You know, how do we all take responsibility for security issues that are before us? And I think this kind of approach, if we find it, and I'm very hopeful, because I was in Munich at the Munich Security Conference, and the support which the Medvedev proposals received there, not in terms of, you know, Russia's blueprint for European security, of course not, but there's an opportunity to now, 20 years later, unfortunately, 20 years wasted in my view, we engage in a serious discussion with the Russians, with others, hopefully with Central Asia, decisions, possibly with Chinese, with others, together, you know, how do we deal with European Eurasian security seriously? And I think this is a great opportunity for us, and this is where, in my view, we should be investing our resources, not in a kind of extending the post-Cold War logic, which is not going to be helpful.
Right. Sir?
Well, Georgi Babidze, Georgian ambassador. It's a question to Oksana, and it may sound as a complaint. Oksana, you mentioned the need for normalization of Georgian-Russian relations for any progress with Georgian integration into Western institutions, and I wholeheartedly agree. But while Georgia's, including this current government, has started all this effort, with the first step was an approach to Russian leadership, trying to exactly improve those relations, and there were very few real conditions for that on Georgia's part, that was just recognition of Georgia's own territorial integrity. And we admitted that we were ready to take into account Russia's legitimate security interest in our region. We never learned what Russia wants, what Georgia should do to deserve a normalization on Russia's part. Do you know what they would expect?
Well, I think the relationship in any international relationship is not about the kind of frozen in time exchange of menus and then the strategic bargain between the two sides, however symmetric or asymmetric they are. In my view, it is a process. It is an investment in the relationship, which is hard, particularly, you know, with a relationship which has a lot of very difficult history behind it. And I think as much as, you know, Gary said very, very, very rightly that Georgia should have legitimate grievances about the occupation by the Red Army, but the Russians also have a lot of grievances about Stalin's heritage and about lots of other things that happened during that era. And I think there's lots of issues there now, which is very, very difficult to disentangle. But I think, you know, we need to learn from other experiences. There's not a single relationship, you know, along the Russia's borders in the post-Soviet space, which is so fundamentally dysfunctional and hostile between Russia and any other countries. And each of them, and I travel a lot in Central Asia, I travel a lot in other South Caucasus states, be it Azerbaijan and Armenia, each of them face a lot of difficulties in managing the relationship with Russia. In my view, Georgia never tried to manage this relationship. I think the attitude of this government, of Saakashvili's government, partly maybe because he does represent, of course, new post-Soviet generation. He wants to think pragmatic. He doesn't want to deal with the Soviet heritage, which unfortunately in many ways defines this relationship in the post-Soviet area. You know, he just decided he doesn't want to invest in this relationship. And I think just saying a few words about we want to hear what the Russians say, what their legitimate interests are, of course the Russians themselves probably don't know what their legitimate interests are. They do not have this very, you know, methodical, you know, discourse which Sir Gary just put on the table. There are all sorts of competing factions within the Russian government, each of them formulating these interests very differently, some in economic terms, some in military terms, some in geopolitical terms, some in geographic terms, some in, you know, Northern Caucasus terms. There's all sorts of actors involved. But I think, you know, it is impossible to get this relationship worse than it has been for years. And now is the time to try transforming it. But I'm not very optimistic, I think, that it's going to happen in the foreseeable future. But it will happen eventually, because I think it's in the interest of both Russia and Georgia to have this relationship normalized.
But may I just press you on the ambassador's question? Because when we were in Moscow, we would ask, you know, what does Russia want? And Russia does seem to be specialized at avoiding the question about what it really wants and turning the discussion into one about process. I mean, this makes Russia very difficult to deal with. Do you understand that?
And if I may, I'm not quite sure I understand Russian grievances about the Stalin spirit. Do you mean that Georgia had a look like Russia at the time?
No, I mean, I think, no, I mean, you know very well the debate, so I'm not going to, you know.
No, I honestly didn't understand that.
No, the fact that Stalin was Georgian, the fact that Beria was Georgian, the fact that there has been a lot of repressions also against the Russian population. And there has been all sorts of grievances there, which are the part of our common past, which we have to, you know, this is the area in which both sides, all sides in fact, have to look together how to deal with the historic legacies. But this is part which also influences the perceptions which you know, which people have vis-à-vis each other. And this is the truth not only with the Georgians, but also with many others. But in terms of, you know, can then they formulate what they want from Georgia. No, I mean, I think it is very difficult now when the relationship has become so dysfunctional to say, okay, if Georgia fulfills this, that, and the other, the relations are going to improve. It's going to be a very, very long process. You know, Russia and Georgia has been just, you know, fighting a war. And there are obviously completely different views about this war on both sides.
But why won't Russia even observe the agreement made with President Sarkozy?
Well, I don't know. I think from Russia's point of view, I guess, you know, I'm not defending it, but I'm just stating it. I think from Russia's point of view that they have fulfilled the agreement as they see it, because they, of course, do not consider, you know, Georgia and South Ossetia to be part of Georgia anymore. And, of course, this is an impossible situation, but this is not a unique situation to the Caucasus and to Russia. There's a number of other cases in the world.
Such as
North Cyprus, such as Kosovo at the moment, where there is a fundamental disagreement, and that is not just the Russia's problem, it is the problem of the international law, where there is a problem, there is a fundamental, you know, challenge for us, an unresolved legacy of how do we deal with the issues of territorial integrity versus the rights of nations for self-determination. And of course, you know, having spent so many years of my life going to Abkhazia and South Ossetia and listening to the population there, you have to also be able to listen what they have to say, you know, with the families that lost a lot of their children, you know, in several generations to the Georgian, you know, attacks and the Georgian aggressions, which unfortunately does not reassure this population that they will be able to live at peace as part of Georgia, and that their fundamental human rights and national rights and are going to be sustained there. And I think it is up to Georgia, in my view, to show to them and to prove to them that they could be real citizens, you know, real part of the Georgian state, and Georgia being attractive to them. It has happened to many other post-Soviet states. In Kazakhstan, for example, there is a very big Russian minority, and there was a lot of speculation that there will be a conflict in Kazakhstan between Russians and Kazakhs, but the Kazakh government was very prudent after the collapse of the Soviet Union to create an environment in which more Russians actually came to Kazakhstan than left Kazakhstan, and they feel very much part of the of the society there.
Lord Wallace.
I'd like to believe in the very rosy scenario that Oksana paints, but since we've got several problems. First of all, the NATO problem, which is the new members of NATO still believe that the main purpose of NATO is to protect them from a potential Russian attack. So that's a large question about what NATO is for now, which most of us need to confused about. And then there's the question of whether or not one can strike common ground between the view of the Russian elite on their space and their sphere of influence and their role in any European security system and the view that we think is acceptable in this. Now, my conversations with people close to the power in Moscow suggest to me that their attitudes to the Georgians is about the same as English aristocrats towards the Irish in about 1850. And the whole set of issues, which, and that's not just about South Caucasus, Russian attitudes and therefore policy towards the North Caucasus, fit in with this. So it seems to me we're a very long way from achieving the reconciliation, which then provides you the basis for a wider security organization, which you're suggesting is the only answer.
That's a very brief response on this. You know, if we look at the Helsinki Plus idea, which seems to be now prevailing both within NATO and the European you know, discourse of how to move forward on this, you know, Medvedev proposals and those ideas. That I think if we look at the initial Helsinki process, of course, it took 2,600 meetings at that time to negotiate this. It took 6 years to find the formula in which in such diverse actors at the Soviet Union and at that time NATO countries were able to find a compromise. I do not believe that we are today in a worse situation when we will not be able to find the modus vivendi which actually brings us to an agreement on the common principles, you know, in which we, you know, can agree on within the wider Eurasian space. And I think if we cannot come to this compromise today, that we all, you know, are just so irresponsible in front of the next generations who will then have to be dealing with this failure. And I think, you know, overall, if one looks at this issue of reconciliation, you know, and how Russians perceive, I think it all depends very much to which Russians you talk to, you know, and it depends on how, what attitude is being taken against this perception. I was in Central Asia in August, after the end of the war in the Caucasus, and I have seen how all Central Asian states have stood up to Russia and said, we're not going to recognize Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And that was not easy. You know, the Russians applied a lot of pressure, but they did. But it did not lead to breakdown the relationship with any of them. With any of them. It is possible to manage, you know, Russia's pressure. It is possible to manage Russia's concern and Russia's, you know, policies, but still keep it in the environment where common interests can be kept in mind and acted upon, not, you know, leading to the conflict.
You're being wonderfully articulate, and we're enjoying that very much. Do I gather we have to finish at two? At two. So I've got 4 minutes for two more questions, which are three more questions, if they can be very brief, and then we'll have final comments from our panel.
Jamie Brockbank, Ministry of Defence. I've got a question about the coupling of Georgia and Ukraine's
very quickly, please.
Action plan. Is that sensible, or should we be looking at them on a case-by-case basis? And tied into that, I'd be interested to hear your views on geopolitical significance of Sevastopol, the Russian naval base now.
Okay, and I'm going to make it four questions, I'm afraid. You'll need to make notes, because I missed out this lady at the front here. I do apologise. You're next.
I thought the presentations were very interesting, but very Eurocentric. Oksana went some way to correcting this in her responses, which were excellent. But specific points. Talking about energy from Central Asia, ask anyone in the oil and gas industry, and look at the map, look what's being discussed, even in the financial pages of our own press, and you'll see that it's not a question of Russia's role, it is a question of a growing demand in the Asian countries. And Central Asian gas and oil, increasingly, is going to China, to India, to Korea. And Russia is positioning itself in that game. And I think to talk about Central Asian oil and gas as being somehow or other designated for Europe is living in a dream world. Afghanistan, you touched briefly on it, but that surely is one of the big security issues for us today. Clearly we need to cooperate with Russia on this. It's already been discussed because of the upset of Pakistan. And in talking about NATO being split, it is deeply split over Afghanistan. So when we're talking about expansion, in a way, this is a side issue.
Right.
That is the real thing. Finally, on the financial crisis, it hasn't come up. I know from the American side, they are beginning to see one of their top security threats as being precisely the financial crisis. Again, we need to be thinking about Russia. One very small point
on Abkhazia
and Ossetia. I think Oksana was absolutely right. We hear about Russia, we hear about Georgia, we hear about the West. We do not hear what the views are in Abkhazia and Ossetia. And I do know from the ground there, as it were, they do feel very strongly about this along the lines that Oksana mentioned. So I think we need to get away from being entirely wrapped up in our own interests, our own views of things.
Okay. The last two questions, if they can be as brief as possible, you and then you. Say who you are, please. And yes.
Thank you very much. The President of the Russian Embassy, I think that the right not just to make a question.
Of course.
Little comment on the term in this discussion. The purposes of the requirement of Russia. I can't be parties in the project.
We can't hear what you're saying. Can you speak up?
Okay. First of all, on Georgia, I would like to remind you that it was Tbilisi who broke diplomatic relations. In the diplomatic practice, it has been not the usual situation that the country which breaks diplomatic relations then takes steps to establish those relations. The requirement of Moscow, I think, towards not only Georgia, but towards all our partners, is just recognizing and realizing the realities, the existing realities, and taking into account the concerns of the others. And I quite agree with the opinion that this issue of integrating Georgia into NATO is it's not only about Georgia, it's much wider. It's about the decision the NATO countries, first of all, have to take strategic about the direction in which they see the future development of international relations, and in particular of their relations with Russia, whether they have an interest in having good relationship with Russia, or whether they are going to enhance their own security through confrontation with Russia. The other choice would be, I think, to choose real cooperation, taking into account the concerns of the others, sort of reapproachment of detente, new detente. And by the way, I think so far we've seen some positive signs in this direction from the new American administration.
Thank you very much for your contribution. Final contribution?
Well, just on Ukraine, I mean, I do think that Ukraine, of course, has come much closer to the realizing the actual, qualifying on the grounds that I mentioned in my presentation to come closer to NATO, much more than Georgia did. Unfortunately, in the last several months, the developments in Ukraine are extremely worrying, extremely worrying. I think the instability has reached the point where I think it's the country's, you know, future direction of development, not to say governance, you know, at the time of severe economic crisis, are really put in doubt. And I think Ukraine has to now prove to the international community, to Europe, and to its own citizens that it's able now to pull together, you know, to be able to resolve this domestic crisis. And until it is done, I'm afraid, you know, we are not going to see any progress done either in relations with NATO or the EU. But I also think that if the serious crisis can occur in Ukraine, in my view, the probability is increasing. I cannot see Russia not being involved, and I think in this situation we will unfortunately see developments which will put the August events very much on the margins of how serious impact that could be on the European security. So I think it is very much important for the Europeans now to do a lot to stabilize the situation in Ukraine and put Ukraine back very much on track of relations with EU and NATO.
So, Gary, final word.
If we can stay for tea, we'll deal with Ukraine. I mean, I'd take them separately, personally, because I think they're both difficult, but the magnitude of the problem is slightly different. And we should bear in mind the Russian interest, legitimate interest, in the naval facilities in Sevastopol. We should also take in mind that they just apparently signing a 49-year agreement with Abkhazia to build a military base there. And there are thoughts of a naval port in Otramchiri. So the Russian security apparatus, if you like, structure around the Black Sea is scope for a whole another day. And I apologize to Shirin, if I may. I gave the wrong impression, forgive me, about the oil and gas. It is only a portion, a small percentage that comes west. So the point I was trying to make is if you have a monopolistic control of the passage of that west, it gives you a certain leverage.
Well, I find this question turns on whether we believe in a world where we offer the larger powers spheres of influence, or whether we believe that we have to stand on issues of principle, and the question is where our own security interests lie within that, the balance between those two viewpoints. But I think it's been an extremely interesting